Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast. Warm welcome to the show. Bill Arnold here with you today. Awfully glad you joined me this afternoon. We've got a great show coming up. Dr. Ann Bradley is going to be with us in just a few minutes. Looking forward to chatting with her. I've been studying John 21 all weekend. I think of the disciples, their disappointment in their all-night fishing expedition. That night they caught nothing, though it is probable that they just toiled all night. I think of the vanity of this world. The hand of the diligent often returns empty. I mean, here's an example of good men that came up short of success in an honest day's work. We may be doing our work and not prospering. So providence had it that night they would just catch nothing, that the miraculous haul of fish the next morning might be more wonderful. So sometimes in those disappointments, which to us can feel very grievous, like working all night for nothing, bupkis, God often designs that they're going to be very gracious and generous in how he answers our prayers. So I'm going to talk about economics with Dr. Bradley, so I'm looking forward to that conversation, and I'm going to take just a very short break and then get her on the line. Thanks for listening today. I'll be right back.
Pray Together Sunday is a simple opportunity for churches to join with congregations across America to ask God for spiritual renewal in our country. Ask your church to join us for Pray Together Sunday on July 8th and commit to a time of prayer for our country during your church's Sunday worship service. Together, we will lift our voices on behalf of our communities and nation. Register and find resources for your church at nae.net/praytogether. Pray Together Sunday on July 8th is organized by the National Association of Evangelicals, where we use influence for good.
It is 7 minutes after the hour. I sure hope you had a nice weekend. And now we've got a holiday weekday coming up on Wednesday with the 4th of July. So it's kind of a weird time to have a holiday, kind of midweek. But, we'll take it any day of the week, I would say, if you're looking forward to having a nice time with your family and just sort of celebrating the 4th of July and what all that means to our freedom, which we should not take lightly, of course. Now, here's something I just caught. That if you take a break from social media, it will lead to decreased stress. Taking a break from social media for just 5 days can reduce the amount of stress people feel. A study published in the Journal of Social Psychology found that some of the stress people feel while spending hours on social media can lend to feelings of non-productivity and unhappiness. And my guest knows a lot about productivity and happiness. And that is Dr. Ann Bradley from the Institute of Faith, Work, and Economics. Hello, Ann.
Hi, Bill. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. Now, let's talk about your new book.
Good.
Yeah. For the Least of These, A Biblical Answer to Poverty. Congratulations.
Thank you. We're excited about it.
Yeah.
And we really felt like it was an opportunity for Christians to really be thoughtful about the issue of how do we handle poverty in the 21st century.
Well, let's let's start with how we even define what is poor and what is poverty, if you don't mind.
No, I think that's a good place to start. And, you know, it's a little frustrating the way that we economists and the way that people in general define poverty. We tend to talk about it only in material terms. And, you know, partly we have to do that because we're trying to measure the amount of income that people have or don't have. But we want to reconcile that against other things. So I think it's important to start off by saying the poor, when we refer to that in economic terms, in development terms, and even in Christian circles, what the Bible is obviously very clear that we're called to care for the poor. And in many of those references, it's talking about the materially poor and the materially excluded. But I think poverty is also a big spiritual issue as well. So those are two different sides of poverty. This book, we're really addressing the material aspects. And so we kind of use the metrics that the World Bank and others use for material measurement, which is about $1.90 a day. That is considered living in abject poverty. And we know, though, of course, that even, you know, let's say you make the move from $1.90 a day to $3 a day, that's really good news.
Mm-hmm.
But we want to see the long-term sustainable progression of people getting out of $3 and $4 a day and getting to kind of what we call the healthy, wealthy corner of the world, where countries like people in the United States are living, you know, not only just they're better off materially, but they have access to healthcare and shelter and things like that. And also they live longer, healthier lives. So mm-hmm. I think there's a much bigger way to think about poverty.
Mm-hmm. And talk about the importance of work as it relates to poverty.
Sure. I think the way we can reframe the conversation about poverty is that people who are consistently, persistently, maybe we should say poor, are people who are largely excluded from work opportunities. Now, people can be poor for a lot of reasons, of course, and the reason that people may be poor in Baltimore, Maryland, might be different and is different than the reason people are poor today in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and we want to take those on a case-by-case study, but we want an environment where people are able to live into their creative capacities. And,
mm-hmm.
In the book, we go right to Genesis to understand who are we as people made in the image of God? What are we here to do? And how does our fight against poverty, how does it needs to start with that premise that people who are able to work, that's an important caveat, that we're affording people a society that allows and encourages work. And so I think you can see, when you start to look at cases of poverty, people tend to be excluded from work for a variety of reasons. I mean, think about living in a very poor country today. If you have to spend all your day just trying to find a meal, engaging in subsistence agriculture, really trying to protect your family from, drug lords or a tribal kind of, feuds and these types of things, it's very hard to kind of think about, well, how's that person going to work? How are they going to start a business? It's very hard. So we want to think about what are the institutions and societies that foster work, unleashing the creativity of people. And then this, again, allows us to get the income that we need to care for our families, care for our communities, and kind of give back in different ways.
Mm-hmm. And as a guy who lives in Minnesota, I'm having, I think, sometimes a hard time understanding this scenario you just described, this family that spends all day trying to get a meal, and then they're fearing drug lords and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
What do we do to help those people?
Well, I think it's very hard to think that we can, change these things overnight. And I think it's also very hard to say, well, what does one individual that's so far removed from the very people that we care about, how do we help? And I think there's a couple of ways, and that's what we really try to do in this book, is say, what does the Bible say we're supposed to do? We know we're supposed to love our neighbor. We try to extend the concept of neighbor. The neighbor's not just the person in your community, of course, that is your neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
But, our fellow human beings across the world are our neighbors. And so what brings us together with them? How do we help them? And so I think a couple things we can do is just be very careful about, investigating what people need before we run in and help. I think sometimes in wealthy societies like the United States, we have a lot of good intentions. And I've been a part of a lot of this. You probably have too in your church organizations. We do mission trips. We do coat drives. We do kind of hunger drives for people in the developing world. We can do a lot of those things, and they can be very good things. But sometimes I worry about whether we're really aware of what people need, and I'm not sure we can know that unless we ask them.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing we can do is, where is God calling you or me or any of us to go? It could be your backyard. It could be Democratic Republic of the Congo and anywhere in between. And go with that first, but then say, what do people there need? And how am I going to discover that? Because otherwise, I think development and aid and humanitarian efforts are kind of working in the wrong direction. We are kind of giving people what we think they need instead of going into a community and environment and saying, well, what do you need and let me help you respond to that?
Mm-hmm. I think that takes a lot of intentional thinking and praying, because there's a lot of people in the car right now going, I need to concern myself with picking up the kids from soccer.
That's right. That's right. And those are important things. We all have to pick our kids up from soccer. And so I think you're right. It's easy sometimes to just not be thoughtful and not be prayerful. And
right.
Just, well, my church is doing the coat drive. Let me just do the coat drive. And I'm not bashing coat drives. They're good. But I think you're right. It takes a long time to help people in the way that the Bible calls us to help.
Yeah.
That's the biggest lesson for me, is that it's about relationships too. We have to know people to help them.
Poverty is so complex, isn't it, Ann?
It really is. It really is. And you know, again, in the United States, when we think about poverty in our communities and our cities, that's complex too. It's not just because the society has never been wealthy. It's there. You're looking at a different set of issues, and maybe somebody's homeless or has been ejected from their home because they have a drug problem, but maybe it's because they lost their job in the recession and they can't get it back. And
mm-hmm.
So again, how are we going to help people without knowing them first and getting, walking alongside of them? That's
yeah.
What we need to do.
And has the government more less helped or hindered this process?
That's a big question. So I'm going to try to answer it in a couple of parts. I think if you overall are speaking about the federal government's initiative, what we call the War on Poverty, which is 52 years old, I believe, I'm not sure we can call this a success. And maybe that's me putting it too generously. It really hasn't moved the needle. The percentage of the population living in poverty when we started this program is about the same as it is now, and we've spent trillions of dollars.
With a T?
With a T.
Trillions.
So I think that's trillions. And that's I think we can say, oh, it's just the federal government. They have trillions. It doesn't matter. But look, this is money that we are called to be good stewards of. So if we're doing things to help people who are excluded, marginalized, we have to be doing a good job. It's not just enough to say, well, they're trying. Maybe they'll get it next year. No, we have to say, if we're not doing a good job, what is it going to take? What's broken? And actually, if you look at welfare reform that was kind of worked on in the 90s, I think there was some important work done there. And it ties back to the importance of work. We don't want to create cultures of dependency.
Right.
We don't want to rip apart families, which is what some of this welfare system has done. So I'm not saying we shouldn't help people. My question is, how do we help them better? And, one way to do that is really to make it as local as possible.
Okay.
Think about the city you live in. You're much more poised to help the people you're closest to than the federal government is, by a bureaucrat helping someone hundreds of miles away.
Very true. And let me take a short break. When we come back, more with Dr. Ann Bradley from the Institute of Faith, Work, and Economics. It's 17 minutes after the hour. We'll be right back. It's 19 minutes after the hour. Bill Arnold here talking to Dr. Ann Bradley from the Institute of Faith, Work, and Economics. We're talking about her new book that she has, I think she contributed to and edited. It's called For the Least of These, A Biblical Answer to Poverty. And right before we went to break, we were talking about the government either helping or hindering. And I sometimes think people never like being told what to do or what to think. And at the very core of that is rebellion. And are we wise to have the government tell us what to do and how to care for people?
I think we should approach that with really, great skepticism. And it's not because people that occupy these government offices that are, established to care for the poor are evil or stupid or have bad intentions. It's none of that. It's the point that makes government, again, as far, federal government, I think, suffers from this the most, maybe one of the worst candidates to do the helping, is because it doesn't have the knowledge of how to help across such a broad swath of Americans, nor does it really have what we call in economics the feedback mechanism. So, see, entrepreneurs that's what is good about entrepreneurship, is that when customers like something that you do, you get a profit, and when they don't, there's a loss. And so entrepreneurs have to very quickly adapt on prices, quality, affordability, all these types of things. But government bureaus don't have that. It's because they're not firms. And so whenever we're going to ask the government to do something, we have to be very aware that there's going to be a higher level of waste and a higher level of potential abuse.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, to me, it seems like if you look at the history of, you know, the United States, what a week to talk about that also, by the way, it was one where for many, many, many years, people in local communities helped each other without a federal government
right.
level of assistance, right? I mean, this is how we built what Tocqueville talked about, you know, kind of this robust civil society. He said, people are coming together in communities and they're helping each other. And you know, we said the reason they do this is because religious life in America and the values that instills is so important for the kind of fabric that brings different people together. And I think that's something we need to reconsider in 21st century America. I think some of that we're losing. And so how can we get that back? We shouldn't default as Christians. The government's going to take care of the poor. I don't have to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have to say, how can I do this better? What is my, I mean, the local church is the hope of the world.
Right.
The church is the institution that is best positioned, not just to materially care for the poor, but to spiritually care for the poor. Because that's really part of our mission, isn't it? It's not just about money and access and income. We care about those things deeply, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But it's about something so much more that the church offers that the federal government can never offer.
Yeah. And does God want the state to be redistributing wealth? I know it's an odd question, but I don't know how else to ask it.
Yeah, it's a big question because there's a lot of debates in Christian circles about what should the government do. We know that Scripture talks about the state and warns us both, you know, of what the state is capable of, but also asks us to respect the state. So this is a complicated issue, but, you know, I really think that there are limits on what the state can do in terms of redistributing wealth. And the other thing is, if you go back to the Decalogue and the Ten Commandments, private property is mentioned more than one time. And I think this matters. So when the state's going to redistribute income, how does it do it? Well, it taxes people who have a lot, and it gives it to people who don't have as much. And let's just assume, we've already mentioned why this might be a problem, but let's just assume they can do that very efficiently and without any possibility of corruption. There's still the bigger question, which is, do they have the legitimate moral authority to do it? And I'm not convinced that they do. I'm not convinced that they do. If we're just talking about wealth redistribution for the sake of either income equality or poverty alleviation. And if you look at the economic literature on this, it is absolutely crystal clear. If you look at the past 250 years of human history, no society has gone from poor to rich because of income redistribution.
Mm-hmm.
Not one.
Mm-hmm.
They become wealthy because they unleash the creative capacities of human beings. And in that, we get cities, we build communities, we build churches, and we learn how to engage in entrepreneurship. And in through that, we care for each other.
Yeah. And so if we think about entrepreneurship, and you think of capitalism at its most basic level is, I want to try to serve my fellow man and in the process get something in return. How is that a bad thing? And why are younger people so antagonistic towards that?
Good questions. I don't think it's a bad thing if we're defining capitalism the way you have, which is ordinary people deciding what businesses they're going to open or deciding what businesses or firms they're going to work for. And engaging in voluntary, you know, kind of buying and selling both of labor and goods and services. And that's what economists mean when we talk about capitalism. And that's a good thing because it's voluntary. One way I've heard it termed, which is, I think, very powerful, is capitalism allows you to engage in a system of double thank yous. So, you know, when you go to work, your boss thanks you and you thank them. Why?
Yeah.
They would rather pay you, right? They'd rather give up the money and have you work for them, and you'd rather give up your Monday then, you know, forego the money.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, we'd all like to get something for nothing, but it's the double thank you. And so that's why capitalism is a good thing. Now, your second question is, why are young people so kind of increasingly against this? Of course, we now have a Democratic socialist winning a primary in New York. So we're not only seeing that people are saying they're in favor of this, we're seeing socialism touted as a political party in the United States more than before. And I think because socialism sounds nice on paper, it's kind of soft and gentle, right? It's, hey, we're just going to, you know, kind of get the rich people and we're going to take a lot of their money and we're going to give it to the poor people. And it's not going to hurt the rich people because they have a lot. And it's not going to destroy entrepreneurship or investment in communities because they still have so much. And look how wonderful it's going to be. And mm-hmm. I think that sounds nice.
Yeah.
It sounds fair. It sounds just. But for all the reasons we've already talked about today, it's not just. Because it requires that you violate the investments and property rights of others, and it doesn't get what it says it's going to get. I mean, no large socialist experiment has ever ended in human prosperity.
That is so true. So when I think of the economic situation right now in our country, and there's the rich are getting richer, and it seems that the poor are getting poorer, and I would say everyone from the youngest age possible was told that they could one day have a job they love. I'm thinking this is true. I could be way off, Anne, but that you could one day have a job and be productive and like going to work and have a family and all that. That's kind of the American dream. What's happened to that?
Well, I mean, there's good news and bad news here. If you look at unemployment, it's the lowest it's been since the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, you know, we are a very wealthy economy. The rich are getting richer. The poor are not getting poorer. The question is, are consumer prices going up in a way that, you know, hurt the poor? And where we see that happening is in housing and healthcare. So that's a real problem. But I mean, I think to your bigger question, what's going on with the American dream? And I think part of it is that, and this maybe gets to what it's like, you know, kind of the cost of capitalism, if you will, which is, you know, do we become so consumerist and do we become so worried about what our neighbors have that we're working for all the wrong reasons? I think that's part of what's going wrong with the American dream, because right now it seems like if you want a job, you can have a job. But that's not the whole question, and that's certainly not what Scripture calls us to. Scripture calls us to create value through our work. And in that we'll be fulfilled, but only when we do what God creates us to do. And I mm-hmm. think certainly if you look at the research, people are pursuing jobs for all the wrong reasons. And I can tell you this as someone who teaches in the college classroom. You know, I think my students are pursuing in some cases the three letters behind their name, the graduate degrees, the jobs that are going to make them the most money, maybe the jobs that are going to bring fame. And that's not the right pursuit. So when we get there, we kind of get ourselves in the hamster wheel.
Yeah.
And we just churn and churn and churn because no amount of money is going to satisfy the ills that are associated with that.
Yeah.
So I think that's part of where we're going wrong.
Yeah. Anne, thank you so much for being on the show. I always look forward to talking to you.
I always do too, Bill. Thank you.
Thanks. Have a great evening. Dr. Anne Bradley's been my guest from the Institute of Faith, Work, and Economics. We'll take a little break and be back with lots more in just a minute.
Certain sorrows that Ashley Slater has faced in life have caused her to rely on God's promises. Hi, I'm Steve Douglas, and Ashley says the Psalms in particular have been so encouraging to her.
Psalm 121, which is one I'm actually having my kids memorize right now, which is, you know, I look to the hills, where does my help come from? My help comes from the Lord of heaven and earth. And I'm reminding them, God who made heaven and earth helps us. You know, he doesn't sleep, he doesn't slumber. And I think that's been good for our entire family, just as far as remembering where our help comes from, that we don't need to be afraid, especially in, you know, today's world, to be reminded who's in control.
No matter what challenges come your way, remember who is in control. You'll find peace and strength in him. Do you need some encouragement in your journey? Go to makingyourlifecount.com.
Welcome back to the show. It's 32 minutes after the hour. Bill Arnold here with you this afternoon. I hope you're having a great day. My next guest, Jane Daly, has written a couple of books. One is called The Caregiving Season, Finding Grace, to honor your aging parents. I know that's a big topic for many of us. Either you've gone through it, you're going through it, or you're about to go through it. So there's always a time to reflect on some of the challenges that lie ahead, and here to do it is Jane Daly. Hi, Jane.
Hi, Bill. Thank you for having me.
You know, I've wanted you on the show for quite a while.
You've been on, well,
you've been on my wish list for a while. Certainly, this is an issue that all of us at one point or another are going to have to be facing, and it there's no manual for it, is there?
There is no manual because everybody's experience is different and everyone's relationship with their parents is different. What I've tried to do is to help people see that there are some basic guidelines, there's some basic things that are common to everyone's situation, but as I said, everyone's different.
Now, I would love to hear some of those because I find it interesting that if, you know, 100 years ago, this wouldn't be an issue. We would be taking care of mom and dad in someone's home, and we would all be pitching in, and now we're trying to find ways to sometimes find a place for mom or dad to go, you know, which in today's world makes a lot of sense because they're getting the best care available. But let's talk about some of the signs that we start to see with our aging parents.
One of the first things that we noticed with my dad was his driving. My mom had mentioned to me that she was a little concerned because my dad was driving in the wrong lane. He was driving into head-on traffic,
Ooh.
And she had to remind him to get over.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had a situation where he didn't quite make it into the garage and scraped the side of the car. Just little signs like that, that my husband and I originally thought, oh, you know, it's just dad. He's getting a little older. His foot slipped, you know, something minor. And it ended up with, as it progressed, we had to take his car keys away, which is just heartbreaking for an adult child to have to take that power over their parent.
Mm-hmm. So that was a pretty traumatic time. I mean, my stepdad said that he kind of would brag that he wasn't in any accidents, but we all kind of said, yeah, but you don't know how many you caused.
Right. That was my big fear. I think around the same time that we took my dad's keys away, or I won't say took them away, my dad gave them up gracefully, which was a huge blessing because I have talked about other people whose parents have not been quite so forthcoming with their car keys. But about that time, there was a lady who was in her 80s, and I think her foot slipped off of the break or something, and she ended up running into a restaurant and killing a bunch of kids. And it was just so traumatic. And we used that as an example with my dad to say, hey, Dad, we don't want this to be you.
Right. So what happens when you start having to call 911 and you're calling over to mom or dad's house and there's no answer and you know they should be there and they're not answering? Talk about some of that anxiety.
It is a constant feeling of being on alert when your parents get older and you know that there's some health issues and that they may fall or get locked out of their house. It's like your adrenaline is constantly right there under the surface waiting to surge. It's extremely difficult. And I would, every time my phone would ring, my cell phone, and I would see that it was my parents' number, my adrenaline would just spike.
Mm-hmm.
Because I thought, what is it now? What is it now? And it seemed like it was always something.
Mm-hmm.
Dad has to go to the doctor. Dad fell down. Mom fell down. You know, something. It was always something.
So, Jane, let's talk about you now as a caregiver. I don't want to shift the focus away from your parents, but these adrenaline surges, these cortisol rages that go up and down. Now, I would have to guess that's going to be taking a lot out of you.
It does. As a caregiver, anyone who's a caregiver knows that it's really difficult on the caregiver's health, on my health. So,
I'm a big believer in supplements, so I take supplements and get enough rest and, you know, all of that. But a long term, it can take a toll on a person's health. And if you're not careful as a caregiver, you can have burnout. And it's just waiting in the wings to happen if you let it. So self-care is huge for someone who's a caregiver. And it sounds almost like, oh, just take care of yourself. It's easy. I know it's not. You just really have to find a way to recharge your batteries so that you don't burn out.
Yeah, and that's really true. But if you're in the midst of caregiving, how do you hold that conflict in your head? It's like you got to take care of yourself. Well, one way to do it would be just to not caregive for a week. But then what's going to happen to the person who needs the caregiving?
Right, and it's almost worse trying to make arrangements for somebody who, when you're getting ready to go on a vacation or even a weekend away. I practically had to have a spreadsheet that said, okay, Monday, this person's going to come over for lunch, this person's coming over for dinner, and then someone's going to spend the night, and then you know, it gets a little nuts, and it's almost like, why bother? Why should I even do this? But it's really important to do that, and the thing that happens is that caregivers can get so fatigued that they end up getting sick, and then they can't care for the person they're supposed to care for.
Mm-hmm.
So you're kind of stuck in this cycle, almost like, you know, a toilet flushing. You know, you're circling, and eventually you're going to be sucked down if you don't take that time you need. For me, my husband and I, We kind of tag teamed in the last days of my mom's life. My mom recently passed away, so I'm on the other side of the caregiving journey. And looking back, I can see some of the things that we did right and then some of the things that we probably could have improved on. But during the last couple of weeks of my mom's life, we tag teamed. He'd take the night shift, I'd take the day shift. And sometimes you have to do that. You have to involve neighbors, friends, siblings, complete strangers, whatever people find together.
So when did your mother stay with you, or was she in assisted living,
yeah,
or how did that work out?
No, we ended up moving in with her last year after she had a stroke, and her desire was to die at home. She just did not want to go into one of those places.
Mm-hmm.
So we did what we could to keep her at home, and she ended up dying at home. So, you know, we're real happy about that. The last 2 weeks was the most grueling time in my entire life.
Mm-hmm.
And anyone who's a caregiver knows what I'm talking about. When you're 24/7, hands-on, you know, the person can't move, can't respond, can't help you, it's really hard.
Mm-hmm. Is that the crisis mode that you're talking about? Is that also the saying goodbye mode, or because did you know the end was in sight?
We did. The doctor had told us when my mom was in the hospital that she had about 2 weeks to live, and she was like, yippee, skippy, I'm so glad I'm going home to be with Jesus. I can hardly wait. And so it actually, you know, she had a really good attitude. But the crisis mode is different. The crisis mode is, oh, my gosh, Dad fell. Oh, my goodness, Mom fell. Or, you know, Dad's sick. He fainted, something.
Mm-hmm.
That's that constant up, down, up, down, up, down. The last during the death part of the caregiving is more of like a constant stress. And then is it going to be today? Is it going to be today? Is it going to be today?
Mm-hmm. So did you sometimes, it was a sacred duty to take care of her, wasn't it?
It was, Bill. I look back and think, I am so glad I had that privilege and was able to comfort my mom in her last days. My mom knows that I'm extremely squeamish, and I'm just, you know, I don't do well with that really personal, hands-on, like, but anyway, let me move on. So my mom had like Depends type things on it. She was just really out of it. And she told me, she expressed to me that she needed to have her diaper changed.
Uh-huh.
So here I am doing that, and she said, I never thought I would see the day that you would do this, because mm-hmm. she knows how squeamish I am. And I said, you know what, Mom? You'll do anything you can for the person that you love. And it was such a blessing for her to know that I was willing to go beyond my squeamishness and do something that I would never have done. And I was blessed to know that I was giving her comfort in her last days just by being a good daughter
mm-hmm.
and a good caregiver, and just showing her love in the best way that I could.
Mm-hmm. Your mom sounds like she was absolutely full of grace, Jane.
Most of the time. I don't want to paint her as a saint because
no, I get it.
We had our moments, but
right.
Yes, she was full of grace.
Did you have siblings involved?
I have the middle brother, so I'm the youngest of three. My middle brother lived in the Bay Area,
mm-hmm.
and he passed away a year ago. And so I'm so sorry. Him because he would come up every 6 weeks or so just to give Mike and me a weekend off.
Mm-hmm.
And so we miss him because it was a year and just not having him. Now, my oldest brother, although he lives in the area, not as supportive. My sister-in-law was more of the one who would come over and visit with my mom, but my oldest brother he couldn't deal with it. He just could not deal with Mom's illness.
Well, that's too bad to hear. I mean, because I get the fact that he was uncomfortable, but he missed a pretty key time in his mom's life.
Well, he did. Yeah. Never mind. I was going to tell a story, but it just paints my brother in a bad light, and I don't want to do that.
Oh, I appreciate that. If you have a question for Jane, I think we'd be willing to take a call or two. Are you all right with that, Jane?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. The number is 877-933-2484, 877-933-2484. If this is the season you're in of caregiving for an aging parent, or if you have lost a child and you're a mother and you've lost a child, Jane's also an expert on that. So you can give us a call or you can email me a question, bill@myfaithradio.com, and we can get that question on the air. It's 15 minutes until the top of the hour. We'll take a short break and be back more with Jane Daly in just a minute. Welcome back to the show. Bill Arnold here, talking to Jane Daly. She's written a book called The Caregiving Season, Finding Grace to Honor Your Aging Parents. And I've got a caller question already. When it comes to a family of siblings, how do you divvy up the care? Or does a sibling or two just naturally take the lead?
That is a great question. It seems like one or two of the siblings tend to be the ones who are more quote-unquote caregivers. And if you can involve all the siblings, that's even better because then you are able to divvy up the care. In my case, because I'm the youngest of three, the only daughter, it just kind of fell onto me by default. So divvying up the care, you really need to have a family meeting and include your parents or parent if they're able to have that discussion and find out who's able to do what when and set up a schedule. It's just really a family meeting is the best thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Jane, can you share an experience that you had in caring for your mom in this season that would be an encouragement to the listeners?
We were a family who liked to spend holidays together. My mom was very instrumental in making sure that we all met at least on holidays.
Mm-hmm.
So we had, when we entered into this season, we had dinner with my parents and my brothers and their wives and talked about what we were going to do going forward. And Mike and I kind of took the lead and said, well, we live the closest, we'll do what we need to do and involve you all when it's necessary. Something that I had to confess before the Lord probably, well, actually while I was writing the book, so kind of in the middle of it, was that I kind of pushed my siblings out of the way and said, wait a minute, I'm going to do this. I'm the daughter. I'll take care of it. I'm the godly one. I'm going to be the one who will arrange everything. And I really think, stole an opportunity from my brothers to be more involved. If I would have just asked them earlier to help. And so I would encourage your listeners to make sure you're not the martyr one like I was, and
mm-hmm.
to involve any siblings who are willing and able and capable of being involved in caring for your parents.
Okay. Another question from a listener named Carolyn. She said, how do you deal with the constant stress of dealing with the great needs of caring for your mom or dad with your own limitations? And then part two of the question is, and how do you deal with the frustrations of siblings not helping out?
Ooh, those are really, really good questions.
I have smart listeners.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I don't think there's one easy way to deal with the constant demands. Caring, I can't emphasize enough how important it is to take time for yourself. And, even to the point of hiding in the bathroom for 30 minutes to get some peace and quiet or
mm-hmm.
read a book. Or the other thing that is really vital is to make sure that your relationship with the Lord is strong and that you're spending time reading His Word, because I found a lot of encouragement just in, the Bible app, just finding one of those devotions that I could meditate on Scripture daily, praying. There's no easy way, because the demands of caregiving are so heavy.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then as far as the siblings, forgiveness and grace has to be huge in your life. I realized that after years of being really anxious and angry, and I just was really mad at my brother for not being more involved. And the Lord showed me that I needed to show grace, and that I was not going to change him by getting angry. I was only making myself miserable every time we would talk about, well, how come your brother is not caring for mom, and they don't call, and they don't come over, and did they realize how much this is costing us? And getting, feeling those feelings is normal, but
mm-hmm.
it wasn't getting me anywhere. It was just making me miserable. So,
yeah.
Grace, and mercy
mm-hmm.
is really important.
All right, Jane, I have another question. I have a caller, Anita from Minneapolis. Welcome to the show, Anita. Nice to have you on the program.
Yes, Bill, thank you and I know I only have a couple of minutes for my question specifically to Jane. Thank you, Jane, for showing up online. The last year of my mother's life was very tragic due to primarily an overdose of medication. I am a healthcare administrator myself, and I was so surprised at the dosage of prednisone that was given, which caused some very, very significant issues that actually caused an enlarged heart eventually, and she died of that.
Sorry.
Question is what can we do with healthcare providers, because it is so broken with the transfer care, if they're going from assisted living to nursing home to hospital and then emergency room, et cetera, to indicate how fragile elderly are to medication dosages and the impact of the spiraling effect of more cost and expense to the system, and we're seeing your mother in a very difficult situation.
Great question, Anita. Jane?
I think that, as you probably know, you have to be such a watchdog for your parents' medications and for their health care. We were blessed in that our primary care physician was the same for my mom and my dad and me, my husband, our kids. So I'm not going to mention any names because I don't want to get him in trouble because of the HIPAA stuff, but we made a point to talk to him about what was going on with my folks because they don't always come home with the right story. They don't catch everything. They don't understand. So being an advocate for your parent, I didn't have to worry so much about them going into an assisted living. My dad did go to a boarding care home temporarily, but you're practically like a watchdog. You have to make sure that you are advocating for your parents' health, for their medicine, and unfortunately, you almost have to be a medical expert to know what are you prescribing, how's it going to interact, what's the dosage, you know, what happens if my mom loses 10 pounds, how is this going to affect the dosage, and all of that thrown into just the care creates that stress that I was talking about that it's so important to get a break from.
I appreciate the call, Anita, and Jane. That is so true. You do have to almost have a small medical degree just to be on top of all the medications and the fluctuations in weight and diet and appetite, and are you getting enough calories and all of that. You're a nutritionist, you're a nurse, you're all of the above, aren't you?
Pretty much. I'm really blessed because my husband was very diligent about my mom's medication. So every Saturday they would sit down and he would fill her pill boxes. And if there was something that he didn't recognize or if he had questions on, he could call the doctor. That was like his responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that not everybody has a spouse or a brother or sister who could take that role. So everything may fall on one person.
Mm-hmm.
But it is really important to stay on top of.
Yeah. Jane, was there an unexpected challenge you faced while taking care of your folks? What popped up that you didn't see coming?
I think that role change from being child to now having to be parent was really hard because, you know, as the youngest, I'm the baby, I'm the only girl, I was really spoiled, and, you know, what can I say?
Yeah.
And so then having to make these decisions for my parents was so weird, just hard, difficult to now say, okay, Dad, you can't drive, and Dad, you can't live here anymore, and Mom, you know, you're not going to be able to do X, Y, Z, or your mom, you need to eat. You know, make sure you clear your plate. Just such a role change that is unexpected that you just don't ever think I'm going to have to do that.
Yeah.
And of course, your parents are like, you're my kid. Why are you telling me this? Why are you interested in what's in my checking account? Why are you wanting to know where I'm sending my money, you know, because of the elder fraud? I mean, just...
Right.
It's that role change is so hard.
Yeah. And then, Jane, when it comes to some of the end-of-life decisions, when you're speaking to hospice or in-home hospice, how do you navigate through that?
That's definitely a challenge. We had a hospice company that was not as attentive as we would have liked.
Okay.
So my husband... especially was the watchdog, and he was like a bull terrier, just constantly, Mom needs this, Mom needs this, Mom needs this, help her here, why are you doing this, she needs this, and the decisions then, because she was on hospice, the decisions really fell to us.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have to deal with the Advanced Health Care Directive because that kind of goes away once they're under hospice care. But it's just constant. We were constantly making sure that she was kept comfortable.
Yeah.
And questioning, why aren't you doing this? We don't know what we don't know.
Yeah.
I would love to write a book or an article on when you're parent is in hospice.
Jane, I would love to have another conversation. Unfortunately, we're really out of time. We're up against a hard break. So let me call you again and we'll continue this discussion. My guest has been Jane Daly. Her book, The Caregiving Season, Finding Grace to Honor Your Aging Parents. We'll take a short break and be back with more in just a minute. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.